I love you. Well, let me tell you a story. I want to make sure you get something out of this. You can use this one, I think. It's a story about a Methodist preacher that was getting about as old as I am. He was thinking about retiring, and he had always lived a pretty calm life, and he decided that he wanted to buy a Porsche. And so he went out and took great effort in making sure the car was exactly what he wanted and had all the bells and whistles on it, and he got the tags put on, everything, and he finally pulled it out of the store, and he turned it out west and was driving down the road, and he did not realize, he'd never been in a car like this, he didn't realize how fast he was going, and so he looked in the speedometer, he was doing 90 miles an hour, and just then he looked up, and there was a blue light in the rearview mirror, and he had this unbidden thought that just came into his mind. He said, I wonder if I can outrun that car. And before he knew it, he had leaned on the accelerator, and he was doing 90, 100, 110, 120, and he looked in the rearview mirror, and the cop was still there, 130, 140. And finally, you know, sense hit him, and he said, I don't know what I was thinking about. He pulled off on the side of the road. And the cop was sitting back there, you know, calling in to check him out, you know, and calling the tag in. And after about 5 minutes, the cop came around the side of the car, and he said, I'm just shocked. I cannot believe this. You have a perfect driving record. You have not ever even, no speeding tickets, not even a parking violation. You have a perfect record. And according to my records, you are a Methodist minister. He said, I just cannot believe, you've had a perfect driving record all these years, and here you are in your 60s, and you've done this. Usually the people that run from me like this are, he said, they're running cocaine, or they're drunk, or something like that, and I still understand this. And he said, but I want to be merciful. I'm a Christian, and it's the end of the day, and I want to give you a break, but I really can't give you a break. If you tell me one reason why this could happen, that I've some excuse that I've never heard before, I'm gonna turn you loose. And the pastor looked at him and said, sir, I don't know how to tell you this, but he said, 3 weeks ago, my wife ran off with a state trooper, and I thought you were bringing her back. Well, I wanted to make sure you got something out of it. If you get pulled, it's something nice to say. I want to kind of depart from the notes. I'm going to encourage you to read those because they are very, very important to me, and they're fundamental. But rather than talking to you, just sort of going through the notes, I'm going to assume you can all read, and I want to use my time instead of talking about the notes, which are basically, the underpinning and the explanation about what I am going to talk about. But I'm going to talk about instead how I did that in my current church. I'm in my 13th year at a church called Chapelwood United Methodist Church in Houston, Texas. I'm one of those unusual Methodists that has served in three annual conferences in two jurisdictions. And if you know anything about the United Methodist Church and the polity of the church, you know that's a little bit unusual. That doesn't normally happen. I came to Chapelwood from First Methodist Church in Lubbock, Texas, where I had been the pastor for a number of years. And I had a great ministry there. I would have never, ever left. My wife was she didn't like it. She wasn't happy, and when mama ain't happy, nobody's happy. And so I had an opportunity to go to a, I had a, actually had a couple of alternatives, and I ended up in this church when I went in to interview. I really didn't want to come to Chapelwood, but they invited my wife to come and participate in the interview, and they kind of went, took her out and wined and dined her. And I went there, and the bishop was sitting there, and there was, the committee was there, and it was an august group. And I basically just took it over, and I said, look, you know, I'm happy where I am, and I'm really not sure why y'all brought me down here to talk, but let me tell you a couple of things about myself. I don't want to fly into any false colors. I want y'all to know who I am. First of all, you need to know I'm an alcoholic, and I have been for a long time. I'm in recovery, but I'm not going to be ashamed of that. I came out of hiding about 10 years ago, and I'm not going to do denial about that. And most of y'all are probably not going to like it when the word gets out that your pastor is an alcoholic, and you're going to be a little embarrassed, and I'm not, and so that may be a deal breaker for you. And the second thing you need to know is in 1968, I spent a summer doing civil rights work in Laurel, Mississippi, and I'm a troublemaker. And when I drove in here, I saw all these wonderful cars you have, and I want you to know I'm going to make you get off your wallet, and you're going to have to do something to help other people. And so you probably don't want to talk to me, but I'm going to tell you. And I said, the second thing is, I was following a person that had been there 36 years. And I said, you need to know if this group is not 100% supportive of me coming here. I mean, if there are any exceptions, don't even call me back because I'm not interested. You're asking someone to put their life on the line, and I'm not going to be that person if you're not 100% convinced that I'm the right person to be here. And then I gave him a survey, and I said, here are the 10 roles of a minister. I want you as a group to order them 1 to 10, and I'm not going to tell you what my view of this is. I want you to tell me what you're looking for. And if you're 100% convinced that I'm the right person, and your description is the same as what I feel called to do, then we'll talk. And the bishop nearly fell off his chair. I really came to Chapelwood because we got back on the plane to go home that evening, and I said, well, to Susan, I said, well, tell me how you liked it. She said, well, I think I'd like to move there. And I said, honey, I think I blew that out of the water a few minutes ago. I don't think we'll be going there, but as it turned out, we did. I've been at Chapelwood I'm in my 13th year. When I came, the church was averaging, it had about 4,900 members, and it was averaging a little, about 960 in worship. We don't have much more members than that. We only have about 5,600 members now. We have a lot of requirements, but that they didn't have then, and the attendance is just a hair over 3,000. The budget was about 1.7 when I went. It's 9.2 now, so it's a good bit larger church. Not that many more members. We have sort of requirements for membership, and we tell people pretty much up front that if you want to be a member of Chapelwood, we're going to have 4 commitment campaigns a year. One for prayers, one for presents, one for gifts, and one for service. And if you don't want to do that, don't join. We'll bury you, we'll visit you in the hospital, we'll marry you, we'll do all that stuff. You don't have to do that stuff to join. We'll do that. We'll take care of you. But if you're a member, we expect you to step up to the plate. And that's basically what I gained permission to do. To raise the bar, to raise the standard, and I think that is one of the explanations for how that has grown. When I came to Chapelwood in 1994, I came in and I met with a committee, and I said, "Here's what I want to do my first year," And I laid out a plan, and I said, basically, I want to sit down with everybody in the church. And I want the church divided into neighborhood groups, not Sunday school groups. Those folks already know each other. I want neighborhood groups. And I want to go and sit down with every one of those people, and I want to ask them three questions. Number one, how'd you come to be associated with Chapelwood? Number two, what do you like best about Chapelwood? And number three, what is your vision for Chapelwood? And I had somebody sitting over in the corner writing notes. And at the end of those 3 months that I did that, I knew more about Chapelwood than anybody alive, because I had bothered to listen to everybody. One of the differences in a church start and going to an existing congregation, if you walk in and you have not listened to people, they're going to think you don't respect them. And you build, we talked earlier today about the fact that there's a difference between authority and influence. And you build influence by listening to people. And the second thing I did, I said, I want to bring in a consultant. And in November, I brought in a consultant who could look in a different kind of way at my community of faith. Third thing I did was I focused on blocking and tackling, fundamental, basic stuff, getting the basic stuff taken care of. Incidentally, whenever you go through a crisis, you got to go back to blocking and tackling. It's the basic, fundamental things that make a church strong. And I don't know if you've ever known anybody that lived on a lake. But every time, when you live on a lake and there's a dam, every now and then they let the water out. And when the water's out, it's a great time to fix your dock and to pick up the beer cans from around your place. I used those first few months of the year to kind of shore up my dock and pick up the beer cans and focus on blocking and tackling. I had to raise the money for the budget, and that became a major thing. I had to look for the right person to be my executive pastor. When churches are a certain size, staffing changes dramatically, and I knew I wasn't the right person. I don't lead staff meetings in my church. I don't do any of that kind of stuff. I have about three people that report directly to me. And my interaction with the staff is mainly about spiritual encouragement in their lives. And that was what I basically did. And at the end of that first year, I said, did I do what I told you I was going to do? And the answer was yes. I focused on put together a prayer ministry. What I was talking to you about earlier about writing, dividing your congregation up into 1/50th, and contacting those people and telling them you're going to be praying for them. I put that in place. I have a teaching ministry. Teaching is very, very important to me. I think you're not a very good preacher if you're not a Bible teacher. And that became important to me. I put that in place. By September of 1994, we had grown to the place that we needed a third service. Basically, they had two duplicate services, and we had to have a third service, and we differentiated between the services, and we had them all on Sunday morning. We added a kind of a blended service, really. And early in the morning, we developed a youth choir. We've got a 120-voice youth choir that sings every Sunday morning at 8:25. And we do a children's ministry. That's a great service to attend, but it's kind of a family service. Then we do a blended service. We tried to do some things that made worship exciting. How many of you come from denominations that practice infant baptism? Raise your hand. Most of you. Gosh. I'm going to tell you how we do baptisms. We don't use the liturgy. I'll bring them up front, and I'll ask them hard questions about faith and how they're going to live and how they're going to teach this kid. And then I walk them right out in the middle, and the entire congregation gets up and surrounds these kids. And everybody lays their hands on the shoulder of the person in front of you so that everyone is touching that baby or those babies. And we baptize them because they're being baptized into the body of Christ, you see. And then when I'm through, I hold that baby up, and people all around the room will call out a word of blessing for that child. So there's a rainbow. And somewhere deep inside, you know, psychiatrists say that everything that ever happened to you, you can remember. And I want those children to know that there was a moment in time where they were the most important persons in the world and that people were blessing them. And somewhere deep inside, you're talking about people cry at baptisms in our church. And so we put together worship services that were exciting. I'm an alcoholic, and I've always tried to have a ministry that reached alcoholics. And I knew I wasn't the right person to put that ministry together. And so I started a search pretty quick, about 1994, looking for the right person. It took me until October of 96 to find that right person. And I brought them in October, and from January till September, they had a study group to kind of find how to do this. There wasn't any such thing as Celebrate Recovery or anything like that at the time. And we put half the people that were a part of that group were non-Christians, intentionally. And every person that was a part of the group that was putting this service together was either a member of the recovery community. About all but three of them were members of the recovery community. Those three had all been spiritually injured by the church, by a church somewhere. And so they put together a service that was very, very unique and different. It became on Saturday night. Started off with just a handful of people, maybe 35 people. And it's now probably 650, something like that. It's if you're a part of the, I hear a lot of people talking about Celebrate Recovery. And I really don't agree that Celebrate Recovery is a good thing. The people in the recovery community resent Celebrate Recovery. You're going to hear Chuck Hunter talking about how to do the old paradigm of doing evangelism was believing belonging, and the new paradigm is belonging believing. That it is in the context of community that people come to Christ. My concern about Celebrate Recovery is it's the old paradigm. It's believing, belonging. And it's 9 steps instead of 12 steps. And so people in the recovery community just smell that. And you can be a member of Chapelwood. You could be a member of Mercy Street and not be a member of Chapelwood, not be baptized. But if you are, sooner or later, we baptize 50, 60 people a year. That come to faith because it's the community that brings people to faith. And it is an unbelievable, it's red and yellow, black and white. If you came to Chapelwood, you would see Chapelwood's in a pretty intimidating community. It's in a pretty affluent section of West Houston. If you believe in the conventional wisdom, you would say the people that you would see at Mercy Street on Saturday night would never come into a community like that. They are literally red and yellow, black and white. They're street people. They're the guy who sells papers on the corner of Woodway and Voss is a member of Mercy Street. The wealthiest people in Houston and the poorest people in Houston. We bus people out of treatment centers that come to Mercy Street. We have got street people that come to Mercy Street. And it is absolutely phenomenal. It's amazing that can happen. But they've got a staff of 9 people. They're two preachers that rotate. One of the things I learned from Bill Hybels, which is which I had to do my ministry all over again. I would never be the primary preacher. I would rotate. The ministries we have and I'm going to try to explain in a few minutes that we're kind of a congregation of congregations. And the ministries we have, I'm the only one that is a primary preacher. Everybody else rotates. And they are great preachers. You can't be on my staff unless you're better than I am. And those guys, they are great preachers. And you know, the truth is that they rotate and we lose almost nothing. People don't worry about, they don't come and worry about who the preacher's going to be. One of our preachers at Mercy Street is a fellow who's not ordained. He's smart. He graduated from seminary 4-0, but he's not, he's never been ordained, and he baptizes people and all, you know, technically I could be brought up on charges for allowing that to happen, but it's a dynamic, powerful thing that happens on Saturday night at Mercy Street. We went along for a couple of years, and we needed to have a capital funds campaign to build new buildings. And we built, we raised $16.5 million to build buildings. We enlarged our sanctuary. We built a children's building. We did a whole bunch of stuff like that. And we gave away $3.5 million and raised another $3 million to build a community center in the poorest section near us. We built a medical clinic, a dental clinic, a charter school, a counseling center, a boys and girls club, all under one roof, and gave it away. Our name's not even on it. Because when you raise a bunch of money for yourself, if you don't do something for other people, you're not doing the right thing. I believe that people give us money because they know we're going to do the right thing with it. And people my age, and if you're from 40 to 60 years old and you've got money, and people will not, in that category, will not give money to you if they don't know that you're interested in other people other than yourself. They won't give it to you. They won't trust you. And we tried to demonstrate to people, we're going to do something for other people. So out of that $16.5 million, we gave $3.5 million away. And when we got through rebuilding our sanctuary, it's always bothered me that we have never had a service where every Sunday, every weekend, the Eucharist is offered. I don't know where you are on that, but to me, I don't know how you come off being a large church and don't offer Holy Communion every Sunday. Don't offer anointing to people. People are going to the hospital. People going to doctors. People going to therapists. How can we not offer that every week? And so I sat in a room with a bunch of people planning how we're going to do our services. We're going to have to redo our times, our worship times. And I just said, friends, we're going to sit in this room until we figure out how to do a contemplative service where communion is offered every Sunday. And we finally worked it out, how to do it on Sunday morning in sort of opposite another service. And we have a service that has about 250 people that attend every week that is a wonderful service. Tezé music, Lectio Divina, Holy Communion, anointing. It's led by a Southern Baptist minister who has a PhD in spiritual formation from a Roman Catholic institution, and there's another preacher who's a United Methodist who's with him. And it is unbelievable. Those guys have put together a center for Christian spirituality. And right now we're drawing plans to build a retreat center where we're going to give that away. Basically, we're going to make that available to churches all over the Houston area because we don't need to own that. We just need to make sure it's available to us. But we're training spiritual directors, which is really, I think, the wave of the future. And helping our people to become certified spiritual directors underneath someone who actually knows what they're doing. And I'm not the right one to do that, but you know, I believe in that. And I think it is really, really important to do that. So that becomes another little congregation of people, creating side doors for communities to gather. That a lot of those people that come to that service have no idea who I am. I have never preached in there because I'm always on the other side. I preach once a year at Mercy Street. Those people don't know who I am. I don't go most of the time. But it's very, very, very important to me. A couple of years later, we began looking for the right person to do a Gen X ministry because, we were not doing a good job of reaching young adults in their 20s and very early 30s. A lot of them came to church, but in terms of targeting large groups of them, we just were not doing a good job of that. And again, I didn't think I'm the right person to do that, but we put together a task force, and they took us about another 7 months to get it. We have a service that takes place on Sunday afternoon, and it's somewhere between 85 and 120 young, single, sharp young adults that attend a service called The Table. That's another little community that is a part of chapel. A lot of those people don't know who I am. I preach in there usually about once a year. I go in there we're in the middle of another capital funds campaign. I'm right now raising $24 million. And we're going to build a youth facility, an additional children facility, and we're giving away $4 million to do Hispanic ministry. In June, we brought in two more pastors that are going to start services. My executive pastor and the person that we brought in, who's a female, is going to do an off-campus service, a contemporary service that's going to be off-campus, probably 11 o'clock or 11:30 on Sunday morning. We brought in a Hispanic pastor. It took me 7 years to find the right person. We looked high and low. I looked all over Kingdom Come. We had to have an elder, a United Methodist elder, who really knew what he was doing. And we finally found him, brought him in. He's in the process. We bought one of the things we're doing with this expansion, with that $4.5 million, is we have targeted land that is right in the middle of three different areas, and we're going to plant churches. And what we're going to do is we're going to hire indigenous pastors, and he's going to function sort of like a district superintendent, where there are pastors of smaller communities all over the place, and he will be mentoring them and leading them. And we may fail at that, but I think we've got the best shot of it. Our annual conference has failed. And the United Methodist Church has failed, and we may fail too, but I'm excited about it. I want to see Chapel Wood plant another community on the campus that is for people that are mentally challenged. I don't know anybody that's ever done that and done it successfully. We have a large ministry. We have about 80 people that are a part of that ministry. We feel like we can put together a legitimate worship service where they are the leaders and we have a pastor for them. So basically what we have become is a whole congregation of congregations. And all of those fall under the umbrella of Chapelwood. We're doing it differently than the people that are out there doing it. And we're doing it the best way we know how. I personally am very uncomfortable with the idea of sort of sending my videotapes out and y'all put together a worship team. And I know that's the way it's being done, but I wouldn't want to go to a service like that. And maybe that's a prejudice. We have done it on occasion. We do it on Easter, for example, because we can't get everybody shoehorned in, and we simulcast all over the building. But that's not the way we wanted to do it. We're very intentional about who we hire. We hire the best of the best. We have people from all over the world. We have We have people from other countries we've brought in. I meet with these pastors once a week, and I don't tell them what to do. Basically, they have an awful lot of permission about what they do and how they do it. I've often disagreed with them on things, and they were right, and I was wrong. But we have a very, very close relationship. If you're going to have other people that are doing ministry with him, you have to have a high level of communication with them. You have to know them. They have to trust you. You have to trust them. And so I meet with those guys, and I pour my heart into them, and they pour their heart into me, and I pray for them, and they pray for me. And we love each other, and we trust each other. It's my job to build the runway and to make sure that everybody is together. It's my job to make sure the money is there. We do a lot of things together, including raise money. But it's my job to build a highway where everybody is on the same team and where the people know that we're doing ministry together in ways that we couldn't if we didn't do it this way. If you've got a son and your son came to faith in Christ through Mercy Street, and your son was in recovery and was sane and sober because of Mercy Street, I wouldn't have to talk you into believing that what we're doing on Saturday night is a valuable thing and that that's worth your support. And so when the word gets out that you're affecting the lives of people that families haven't been able to affect, they're pretty excited about that. And so it's my job to tell that story, to be proud of the diversity of the congregation, to lift the banner and say that's important. To be honest with you, probably in Houston, Texas, what Chapelwood is most noted for is Mercy Street. If you're in the recovery community and you live within 50 miles of Houston, you know about Mercy Street because it is just a mecca. People come from everywhere. People in the recovery community are exactly what God-fearers were in the New Testament. They are low-hanging fruit. They know God in some kind of way. As a lot of the people that come to Mercy Street, God, as they understand him, is a doorknob or a chair, you know, all kinds of weird things. And you know what? You come in, we'll love you, and we will accept you, and we'll welcome you into our family. And what happens is that community leads them to faith in Christ. And it is a powerful thing that happens as a result. My job is to make sure that we stay on the same team, that we... do you know the history of the monastic orders in the Roman Catholic Church? Are you familiar with that? In the Roman Catholic Church, most of the renewal groups ended up becoming a part of the monastic orders of the Catholic Church. And one of the geniuses of the Catholic Church, instead of saying, "You're not doing it the way we are," they would wrap their arms around them and say, "You are us." And what we've tried to do is put an umbrella out there and say, "You are us." Now, we live in a time where you're going to find out that Willow Creek is doing just the opposite. They bailed on all that. And I think there are reasons for that. And I'm not saying we're right and they're wrong. I'm just saying that because I don't think you can copy other people's models. But the important thing to me for you to know is that you can be in a traditional denomination and a traditional church and do things that the world at large says you can't do that there. You can violate the conventional wisdom. And basically everybody who is doing anything dynamic is out there violating the conventional wisdom. Now, rather than talking, I want to ask if you have any questions and try to answer any specific questions you have. We got about another 12 minutes. Yes.
If you're starting a new church, what would you do
if I were starting a church, if I would have to, because those are my sisters and brothers, and I couldn't, I've always done that. Everywhere I've been, I've tried to. Way back when, I was undercover about it. But I would have to do that because, you know, it's, you know, I'm passionate about reaching those people. And I think they're the easiest people in our culture to win to Christ that are out there. And they just don't know the name. And it's a matter of winning their trust and helping them to see that this is the God as you understand it. So I would have to do that personally. Yes.
What would you say to a skeptic who says, everyone I've ever reached out to who had an addiction ended up failing? I give up.
What would I do if, how would I respond to a skeptic? What,
about the recoverability of an addict?
Well, I would agree with a lot of that. I mean, the truth is that most people that go into recovery, it doesn't take the first time. It didn't with me, and it doesn't with most people. You know, but what would you say to your son? What would you say to your daughter? I mean, what would you say to a Christian? I know a lot of Christians that say, you know, I tried that. It doesn't work. And they bail on it. I mean, how many people are there out there that are injured, have been injured by a church? And they say, don't talk to me about that. I know about that. I'm not interested in your church stuff. You're gonna just throw those people away? Those are people for whom Christ died. How are you going to do that? Yes.
Talk about staffing, about you're hiring the best. How do you go about finding those people? What are some of the avenues that you use?
Staffing, how do you go? we're going to talk about that in May. I don't want to go in too deep into that, but let me tell you this about staffing. Don't ever advertise. You're wasting your money. You're going to go through a whole lot of red tape, and you're not going to get the best way to find the right people is to find people that are really great, that are out there doing those things, and use them as consultants. Help get them to and promise them that you're going to interview and take seriously every person that they bring to you, and send them a book at the end of the process and thank them. But for me, I think it's trust in your gut and say no to virtually everybody that you have any question about. I mean, you have to be really, particularly these pastors that are going to be starting these churches, these congregations. I mean, that is so important. And that they have to really trust you, and you really have to trust them. For my money, they have to be extremely gifted. They have to be really, really, you know, the person that started Mercy Street is on sabbatical this year. He's working on a PhD, and we're paying him. You know, he's been there for 9 years though, and he was a wrestler in college. He graduated from college and seminary with a 4.0. He won the preaching award. He could be a neurosurgeon. You know, these are people that can do anything. And you need gifted people. You never fill positions. You hire people. You don't ever fill positions. Yes?
Would you say more about raising of your membership requirements and also the discipling process of commitment to prayers, presence, gifts, and service?
Raising the bar. basically, what we did was I talked to my leaders and I said, you know, here's what I want to do. If people don't come and they don't give and they don't serve and they don't pray, I want to drop them from the roll. And so they said, okay. And so we expedited the process, and I just started dropping people. I had a fella who was the head of one of the top four CPA firms in Houston. He found out he got dropped from the role. He called up. He said, well, what do I have to do to rejoin? And the person in charge of membership came to me, and I said, well, he has to do the same thing everybody else has to do. You know, he has to do those four things. And if he is, and he said, well, he promises he'll do that now. So he rejoined it, but I'm fixing to delete him again because he didn't do it. So, I think if you say, you know, this is what we really expect, and you're not going to grow as a Christian if you don't do this. And we're here to help to equip you to be a fully formed disciple of Jesus Christ. And the only way you can do that is do these four things. So we have four commitment campaigns a year, literally. Four times a year you fill out a card. And we just tell people, if you don't want to do that, you don't have to join. But we are going to expect you to do this. And we expect you, and people rise to meet your expectations. When the culture changes, those people will respond. Yes.
How do you keep the congregations from becoming jealous or envious of one another?
How do you keep the congregations? We do a lot of things together. There are, for example, when we're having commitment campaigns, we're all having commitment campaigns. Everybody sings off that same sheet. We do an awful lot of retreats together. We do. One of the neat things we've discovered is we've got a big children's ministry and youth ministry at Mercy Street. And one of the things we have discovered is these street kids get along perfectly with our West Houston kids. You know, they don't have a problem with this. We were all nervous about it, and we had a bunch of dances and everything. We hired a bunch of policemen. We were scared to death. We don't have any problem. We do a lot of stuff together. And the space we're about to create for youth space is going to be jointly used space. And I try to say over and over and over how proud I am of all those groups. And I try to stand them up in our worship service, and they lead worship service. And I tell people, I put my arm around them and tell people how proud we are of this. Yeah. Our people are proud of it. And but you gotta stand up, put your arm around him, and embrace this, so that there you don't have that kind of jealousy. How about one more? You want to see the bridge in Honduras? This is cool. This is my view of what the 21st century church is gonna look like. Most of us are, see, the river used to be over here where the bridge is, and a storm came, blew the river over. And in my judgment, if you're trying to do ministry in the 21st century, the way you did in the 20th century, sooner or later, your church is going to just look just like that bridge. And you're going to have to find a way to become relevant to the world in which you're going to be living in. That, to me, is the picture of most of our churches in the 21st century. You know what I'm excited about? One of the things that I didn't get a chance to talk about today is that it was on that 141 list, is that the way things are is a human invention. The way things are was a human invention. And if you can vision it differently, it can be different. And the exciting thing about the 21st century is every institution and everything that has existed in the 20th century is going to disappear. And that can either threaten you or it can excite you, because you get an opportunity to redraw the lines much closer to what Jesus meant by the kingdom of God. But if you don't vision that, and if you don't resource that, and if you're not working at that, it's not going to happen. You don't want that to be the picture of your church moving forward. I enjoyed it.